The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Today, I'm announcing the United States is targeting the main artery of Russia's economy. We're banning all imports of Russian oil and gas and energy. That means Russian oil will no longer be acceptable at U.S. ports, and the American people will deal another powerful blow to Putin's war machine. This is a move that has strong bipartisan support in Congress and, I believe, in the country. Americans have rallied to support the Ukrainian people and made it clear we will not be part of subsidizing Putin's war.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon. There was just a brief soundbite from President Biden's press conference this morning. And, of course, addressing the issue of Russian gas and oil and where we stand on it, whether or not we'd be importing more or not. Good afternoon. It's good to be back with you. I'm Drew Mariani. Before we kick off today's broadcast, I just want to send a giant thanks to Ed Marcy, who sat in with me this past Friday while I was away from the microphone. And it's good to be back here with you today. I'd ask everyone at the very top of my show, one of my very important producers on the show. I've got two great producers, Maggie and Tom, who work with me pretty consistently here. And one's my right hand, the other's my left. And Tom, his daughter had to go in for emergency surgery, young girl, I think she's only 30, 32 years of age, and just got out of surgery this very moment. So if you could remember her in your prayers today, and especially for the Siskevich family, I know they'd be grateful. We'll remember them, of course, at the chaplet, which is coming up in about an hour. So if you'd like to join me for prayer, put it on the calendar or set your watch, and you know, we'll do that, and we'll pray for whatever needs you might have. But be grateful for your prayers for the Siskevich family. Very, very critical surgery, too. But thank God she is now out and in recuperation, and we'll continue to pray. Let's pray also for this war that continues to rage. Day 13 now, right, between Russia and Ukraine. Surprising. I really thought it would be a 48-hour war with the military might power that Russia has. But this war continues unabated. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, he gave a very rousing speech today, by video, of course, to the British Parliament. It was a speech which brought the entire body there to their feet. They stood up in a standing ovation. He's outnumbered and outgunned, and he keeps asking for a no-fly zone and needs more military support. The U.S. said, no, we're not going to get engaged in a no-fly zone because, of course, there's going to be problems in the, you know, potentially making this a third world war. Russia warning anybody that gets involved that there would be problems. But look, in addition to this, President Biden finally announced a ban on Russian oil imports. You're going to hear more about that coming up a little later in the show. We'll also talk in our 4 p.m. hour a little bit more about Russia and really, what's happening here, this human holocaust that's taking place among so many innocent civilians and the massive exodus that we're seeing from that country. So we'll give you a 360 view of this throughout the day. There are 2 million refugees. Just on that note, I was sharing with a friend this morning that, you know, I remember the Rwandan exodus. It was the largest exodus in modern day history, 1.5 million refugees when you know, Rwandan Tutsis tried to exit that country when the Tutsis began to massacre them, right? It was horrible. They went to Zaire and Tanzania and all these neighboring countries. 2 million refugees right now are leaving Ukraine. And I think that number is going to continue to get larger. It superseded the numbers that we've already thought. And what's inhumane is that the two countries, you know, have reached 3 agreements on establishing these humanitarian corridors for the civilians to be able to flee. Russia has violated those every single time. I can't imagine my wife or my children trying to get out, thinking that, okay, this is our opportunity, and being blown up or landmines along the road or snipers taking certain people out. People in neighboring countries are driving into the Ukraine to get refugees in their vehicles and bringing them back to their borders. The U.S. and its allies, of course, we are still supplying Ukraine with armaments, an ammunition manufacturer in Minneapolis. I saw a piece on him a couple days ago. They're making rounds. Maybe it was Wisconsin. They're sending 1 million rounds to Ukraine. And there's talk right now of supplying them with combat aircraft. So we'll talk, as I said, more about that coming up. Again, President Zelensky wants that no-fly zone. It's going to get dicey. We'll see what happens. So back to my initial point. Let's pray. We have to pray from the heart. We've got to fast. We've got to sacrifice. If this does not escalate, we need to pray for those who are truly victims of what is now unfolding. Joining me today to take a look at this, and of course, you're more than welcome to dial in too. Feel free to join the conversation anytime, is Dr. Daniel Kempton. He was a Fulbright scholar at Rhodes University in South Africa, and again at Tver State University in Russia. And he's published all sorts of scholarly works on the former Soviet Union and its involvement in South Africa. We've been talking to him about Russia, as he's an expert on it. He right now is also vice president of academic affairs at Franciscan University of Steubenville. And he's back once again. Doctor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew.
A lot to get into today, and we've only scratched the surface of this. Let's start with what we're seeing here with the humanitarian exodus. You know, Vladimir Putin, Russia is agreed three different times to allow civilians to leave, and yet we're seeing that part of the tactics that Russia is now using on the Ukrainian people is one of terror. He's bombing civilian targets, and they're killing people trying to flee. And the channels of exodus lead either to Belarus or to the Soviet Union. I'd love your perspective on this. I don't understand the purpose of that, other than just trying to instill fear into the people there, or maybe make them bend out of fear. But you're the expert on Russia. How do you interpret that?
Yeah, I think you're using the term of terrorism might be appropriate. I mean, many people define terrorism in a way that is inclusive of actions committed during war if they violate the laws of war. And one of the most fundamental laws of war is you shall not target civilians. Now, you can inadvertently or accidentally kill civilians, but it's becoming increasingly obvious that what Putin is doing is targeting them. And we're not sure why, but certainly there's a frustration level on his part. And what he thought would be a quick, decisive war is turning into a very prolonged, bloody war as the Ukrainians continue to resist at a very high and almost even more intense level.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Well, Russia's issued a list of demands to Ukraine to end the war, but it almost sounds like Russia wants Ukraine to give up its sovereignty. The Washington Examiner was reporting earlier today that, you know, the demands include all military action, you know, is changing its constitution. They want to ensure neutrality. They want to recognize that Donbass region and vow never to join NATO. Those are unrealistic demands. So how do you see this playing out? How do you see it ending?
Yeah, I think they are unrealistic, and I don't think they've really changed from the beginning. I think Putin started out with two really basic objectives. One was to take land that he wants for cultural, political, geostrategic areas, including the Donbass region, Crimea. It's increasingly clear that for economic reasons, he wants the entire Black Sea coast. There are major oil and gas finds off the coast. He doesn't want Ukraine producing those fields and does want them to be future Russian wealth. He also wanted to put in power a neutral sort of puppet Russian state in Ukraine. I don't think he's backed off of either of those two basic pushes, still demanding them. So I don't think that's a good faith or serious bargaining effort on his behalf.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Is Putin basically demanding Ukraine just let him take over the country? Is that the bottom line here? I mean, it's just like, you know, I'm not going to stop until you submit, but he's destroying the entire infrastructure and he's certainly not winning the hearts of the people. So I don't think he's got the personnel to maintain that territory. So I'm a little confused over what the end game is here.
Yeah, I never thought he wanted to try and occupy and control the whole government or and the whole country. As you point out, that's certainly, we now know, that's beyond the means of the Russian military and the Russian government. I do think he wants permanent control of some of the Russian-speaking lands and the lands that he thinks are both geostrategically and economically critical, which is much of the Black Sea coast, all the way probably from Odessa up to Donetsk. So he's got that. I think he would be satisfied if he could put in place a government, a puppet regime that would essentially accept that the Ukrainian government would always be deferential to Russian interests. And I think that was the vision in the beginning. But as you say, it's harder and harder to do because the Ukrainians hate and hate him more as this goes on, and with good reason.
You know, I sit back and I wonder, and we'll talk probably about the, and I'd like your take on this too. I'm going to talk a little bit later about the moral implications of this war. And I made this example to a friend of mine over the weekend. And I said, you know, I look at Vladimir Putin like he's a bully, right? He's on the schoolyard and he's beating up some young kid, right? Some little kid. Everybody's standing around saying, oh, I don't want to get involved because I don't want him to turn and start beating me up. Because he's warned, hey, if you get involved, I'm going to beat you up too. That's what he said to the rest of the world. Don't get involved. Any nation that does, you know, we'll consider you at, he didn't use the word act of war, but, you know, he would consider them as part of that, I guess, that offensive. The bottom line is this. I mean, what is our moral obligation to stand up to the bully? What's our obligation to say to Vladimir Putin, who's rolled into a sovereign nation, destroyed their infrastructures, killing civilians, who's a bully, who wants his way? The rest of the world has decried this, but nobody's doing anything for fear of getting into World War III. What's our moral obligation, and how close to the edge can we go without saying enough's enough?
Yeah, I think we have a moral obligation just because by international law, there is a prohibition on the aggressive takeover of other countries. So we have a very general one, but we also have a very specific one, to prevent genocide, which I think one can certainly make the argument at this point as he targets civilian that that's going on. And even more specifically, when Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear weapons, that was part of an agreement, and it was signed in Budapest. I believe it's called the Budapest Protocol, but it basically said that the signatories to that agreement would ensure Ukraine's territorial integrity if it would yield up its nuclear weapons. Both we and Russia were legally signed as signatories to that agreement. So the U.S. in particular has both the moral obligation to prevent genocide, under the U.N. Charter, the legal obligation to prevent aggressive war, and the specific obligation under the Budapest Protocol to protect the territorial sovereignty of Ukraine. I do think Biden is being slowly pushed into doing more, and that's good, but it's coming too late. I mean, we've got to get them. If we're not going to set up a zone of protection and a no-fly zone, then certainly we need to find a way to quickly, expeditiously get them the planes they want and Poland's willing to provide them. But we've got to expedite that, not throw up roadblocks. We're letting Putin's crazy statements scare us into not doing what he doesn't want us to do. And that's...
To be honest with you, Doctor, I'm torn over the issue. I mean, I really feel we have a moral obligation to go and defend the innocent who are having their, you know, there's bodies laying on the street right now, and I don't want to be indelicate here, but the snipers and the Russian military won't even let people retrieve the bodies, so animals are devouring them. Yeah, I mean, there's the largest refugee crisis we've seen in modern history taking place, and we're on the sidelines. So I'm really torn. I feel we should go in. But at the same time, Senator Marco Rubio made a statement earlier today. We've got to be careful what we do because this could be World War III. We think it's bad now, but what would happen if, you know, Article 5 is triggered and now we've got a global war? And who's going to draw what sides? Is China going to get with Russia, you know, Iran, North Korea? I mean, what will we end up seeing happen at that moment in time? And nobody wants a third world war if there's a way to get around it. So it's a tough place. I'm glad I'm not in leadership right now. That's for sure.
No, it's a very difficult decision, but there are things we can legally do. I mean, Putin can make a legal argument that if we actually enforce a no-fly zone ourselves, that we become combatants in the conflict. Yeah. But there's no legal reason that we can't allow and encourage and assist. Poland wants to give them MiG fighters, but the Poles say, not now, we can't be left without fighter planes. Well, they want to move to F-16s.
Right.
The U.S. could quickly, easily find those F-16s, commit to delivering them so that Poland could in turn provide its MiG planes to the Ukrainian Air Force. That would be a huge difference. It's not direct involvement. It isn't an act of war, no matter what Putin says.
Yeah, hey, to me, it's a word game, because really you are, in some respects, we don't have boots on the ground, but we're certainly giving them Stingers and Javelins and now aircraft to fight the Soviets. So, but you're right. I mean, there is a distinction there, but I agree. I think we should do all we can, and if that's the way to do it, we should. You know, there's this so-called non-kinetic fly zone or no-fly zone. Explain what that means. And then second, is that something that Putin would allow without retaliation? How do you see that?
Yeah, I don't think he would allow anything in terms of a no-fly zone, no matter how we're choosing to defend it. There are arguments for creating a no-fly zone over the far western region of Ukraine, but that would still mean that we would have to either send our weapons in or send our air force in, but more likely to send in our weapons and shoot things down if they were over it. So I think it's a less threatening thing if we just provide the weapons to Ukraine to let them do it themselves, at least give them the chance, which is what President Zelensky has repeatedly asked for.
So your thoughts on where this ends? So he takes Ukraine. Okay. The military finally wins, which, you know, inevitably they probably are. I mean, they certainly have more manpower and military might than people with Molotov cocktails, you know, and some rifles right now. Let's just turn the hands of time forward a few days, maybe even a few weeks. I don't know. Russia now has dominated Ukraine. Where does it end? There are concerns right now that Moldova, which is a neighboring country just to the west of Ukraine, is concerned they might be next. And, of course, you've got other neighboring countries. But Moldova, of course, is... if I remember correctly, they're not part of NATO, so he could go in there, couldn't he? And then where does it stop?
Yeah, he could, and to some extent already he has. There is a part of Moldova that is very similar to Luhansk and Donetsk, and that is a large Russian-speaking population. It's called the Transdniester Republic, and the Russian state treats it like it's an independent country, but legally it's within the territorial confines of Moldova. So the pattern he's using in Ukraine, he's already started in places like Georgia and Moldova, and I think he will continue to press it. If there is any good news, and I feel horrible even calling it good news, it's that I think Putin thought this was going to be so much easier than it really is, that he's bitten off so much more than he can chew. I mean, the Russian soldiers just seem stunned, the level of resistance, the commitment, the attitude of the Ukrainian people. They were literally told that, you know, they've been taken over by Nazis and we just come in and liberate them. That's going to set him back significantly, the world reaction and particularly the Ukrainian reaction to all of this.
Speaking of Putin's future, he's in a no-win situation, in my opinion. I don't see this panning out for him at all. First of all, the oligarchs can turn against him as their finances are now being squeezed. His own finances have been crushed. The ruble is worth less than a penny right now in the Soviet Union. The stock market there has tumbled. Both domestically and internationally, the man is in a terrible, terrible position right now. What do you see for the future of Vladimir Putin's rule? Is this the beginning of the end? How do you see it playing out?
Yeah, someone may surprise us, but this is a man who's worked for two decades to concentrate the power around him. I mean, even during the Soviet period, during the years of people like Chernomyrdin and Andropov and Gorbachev, there were competing centers of power. Those don't really exist under Putin. To the extent that the oligarchs are important, Putin has literally pulled oligarchs out of power, thrown them in jail, and put a new oligarch in their place when they get involved in politics. That's sort of the unwritten rule for oligarchs in Russia, is if you oppose him, you either leave the country or you end up in jail. I mean, Abramovich, the owner of Chelsea, who's putting the team up for sale, he was once a governor in Chukotka, is how he started out, but he opposed Putin, had to flee the country, basically. Now he's an Israeli citizen. So they're not a source of opposition. Putin has this elite bodyguard around him at all times. They're called the Musketeers, but wow, they're special forces type of guys. They're personally loyal to Putin. He selects them. They serve for a short period of time at the height of their ability. As soon as they're ready to retire, they get a stipend, a retirement for life. They get protection. Yeah. I mean, he set it up that it's so difficult for anyone to get at him, for anyone to push him out of power. So we can hope, we can pray, but it's going to be a tough task.
Yeah, I think his intention is to rule for life. Let me take a quick call because we've got a couple moments here left. Roy is listening in Madison, Wisconsin. Roy, it's good to hear from you. Good afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Joe. I wanted to ask your guest, this just totally, I'm old enough to remember, Hitler kept saying that I'll just take the German-speaking part of Czechoslovakia or Austria and da-da-da and the Sudetenland. It's duplicate, isn't it, sir, of this? I mean, do we not see this and stop him now? That's my question.
Yeah, I think your question is a point, and it's an excellent one. I mean, depends on how you interpret Hitler, but I would agree with your assessment, or how you interpret Putin, but I would agree with your assessment. He is the kind of dictator, the more you appease, the stronger he gets, the more threatened he becomes, and the worse problem you've got on your hands. So facing him early, restraining him while you can, is probably the better strategy. He hasn't gone as far as Hitler, but we certainly can't appease him in all of this.
And my grandkids go to Catholic school in Madison, and they're very concerned about World War III starting. They're all talking about it and scared. And there was a gentleman on Relevant Radio last week that said he can't push the button by himself, and it made us feel better. Do you agree that Putin cannot push the button by himself to start it? He has to have a few others that agree to push the button to start the big one, the missiles?
Yeah, I think that's how it's legally supposed to work, but the people around Putin are so intimidated. I really don't see that procedure as a serious check on him. I wish it was. I wish I could be more reassuring about his behavior. I do think he's an intelligent man, somewhat of an evil genius, if you will. Yeah. But I think he will. He loses in all of that. So if he thinks he's going down, that's where we're most in danger.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's just a final thought here, as I do have to wrap it up. If he knows there's no future, you know, for him, for his role, maybe even for, you know, the finances that he has, why not say, you know, if I'm not going to be able to rule, then this is it, and start a third world war. I mean, he seems like a madman like Adolf Hitler, but then again, some people say he's really not that crazy. That, you know, people who say that really are misspeaking. Is he an evil genius? Does he know what he's doing? How do you read him? Just final thoughts. I do have to go to breaks. Less than a minute.
Yeah, we're sort of guessing there, but I would say, yes, he's very smart. I think he sometimes acts intentionally careless and crazy. And other politicians have done this because Roy was saying we have to call his bluff at times. Well, we do, but it's hard to do that when someone talks like Putin does. And he's had behavior in the past, but this has been the most risky we've ever seen him. Usually he pushes us up to a line, backs off. Not this time.
Doctor, thank you. We'll talk much more about this as a story that's continuing. I look forward to our next exchange.
Thanks, Drew. God bless.
Thank you. That's Dr. Daniel Kempton. You can check him out at Steubenville, of course. And we'll talk much more about this throughout the day. A little bit later, Monsignor Stuart Sweatland will be joining us. We'll talk about war crimes, just war theory, what the Pope has had to say, and so much more. When we return, though, let's talk about how this is impacting your bottom line. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line.
For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
One place.
The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Now.
It's good to be with you today. Always a delight. Boy, I don't know how you're doing today. I got to fill my car up with gas. I was away. And I had my son. He came by to the house, and he was watching our dog, Scout, right? And, you know, he had his car. He parked in the driveway. But as he left later that day, he sent me a text. Hey, Dad, you might want to put some gas in your car. I used it for a little bit. I hope you don't mind. I'm like, that's fine. And I had a full tank of gas. I figured, what did he use? Half a gallon, you know, half a tank or quarter tank? My car right now is on fumes. Literally, it is on. It's below E. You know, I said to my wife, I hope I can get to the gas station. I hope I can get there. I had to laugh. And I understand the cost of gas is crazy. You know, and I, as a parent, worry about my kids, too. I mean, how are they going to make it? How are they going to do it? I mean, the cost of gas is going through the roof. Now, for me to fill the car up, who knows what it's going to cost? I was just talking to my producer, Maggie. She tells me in Chicago, the cost of gas is almost $5 a gallon. The average price right now, according to GasBuddy.com, I think it's $4.21 a gallon. I think Gas Buddy crashed yesterday. So many people were hitting it. That's a website where you can do a quick search on gas stations near you, and it'll tell you which has the cheapest gas. Everybody's looking for it. We actually reached out to them to come on the show today. They're booked for the next week. That's how in demand they are. Solid, they said. Solid. So the president today said he's finally going to end all imports of Russian oil. That's good news for the Ukrainians. Bad news at the pump, although there was a survey done recently that says Americans are willing to bite the bullet for that. I mean, they think the cause of not buying from Russia is well worth paying higher prices at the pump. In fact, people are so desperate to find cheap gas, they're driving. I saw one girl drive, you know, like 15 miles to get it because she figured, hey, even if I fill up, it's worth it. Obviously, look, the thing to do is open up American oil, right? Open up the American oil rigs, get things flowing again. That's not on the radar. The president's going to different parts of the world seeking oil, Venezuela, Iran. But here's the problem I have. We're going to talk with Steve Malloy about this. Venezuela in particular, it's a failed state. It's aligned itself with China and Russia. Why? Because they share the same political ideology, socialist policies. Their oil industry has collapsed. So why the U.S. is going to be going to a failed state that can't even supply its own oil needs, to me, is a mystery. Also mysterious is why you would go to Iran. Apparently, we've been talking with Iran about, you know, of course, the Biden administration wants to restart the nuclear deal. And, you know, that's another factor that plays into this. Apparently, Russia's been involved helping steer these negotiations, which is bizarre. So here we're talking with Iran, the mortal enemy of our ally Israel, and we're using Russia, the mortal enemy of Ukraine, as a mediator. Does that make any sense to you? I mean, when you just zoom out and you look at this stuff, you're like, what? Is any of this making any sense to you? As one person put it, you know, President Biden is going shopping for oil in all of these foreign countries, but he's not even checking here with Texas. So, and he's down there today. So we'll see what comes from there. He's talking about better health care for veterans who've been exposed to toxic chemicals and warfare. But he didn't have anything to say about Texas oil fields. We'll see. We'll see how this plays out. I've invited Steve Malloy, the founder of JunkScience.com, to stop by to give us some perspective on this. And it's good to have him at the table. Steve, good afternoon.
Hey, Drew. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you joining me. You know, I can't wait to get your perspective on this. The average gas price in the country is $4.21 a gallon right now. In northern Illinois, as my producer Maggie was just telling me at the break, she's paying almost $5 a gallon. What should we expect? You know, what are we going to see in the not-too-distant future, and how long do you think we're going to have to deal with whatever is looming?
Well, I think that we are going to see gas prices go up for a very long time. The Biden administration has absolutely no interest in seeing gas prices fall. The most important thing for the Biden administration is its climate agenda, and it has said repeatedly that it wants to see higher prices so that people move off fossil fuels. So, you know, and actually this, you know, Russian invasion of Ukraine actually provides, or they imagine it provides them cover for seeing prices go up.
Yeah, yeah, it's frustrating to me. I'm all for the environment and for, you know, making sure that we're good stewards of the planet. I think we have a moral obligation to do that. But right now we're dealing with a global conflict that could escalate well beyond anything else. And the president and this administration is really putting the U.S. in a very compromising situation. Is climate policy more important than you know, energy security in this country, which is directly related to our national security?
Well, that's quite a loaded question. You know, for me and at junkscience.com, I view climate, the whole climate alarmism movement, the whole issue as a hoax.
Yep.
So this notion that we are going to destroy our economy, make energy pointlessly more expensive for the, you know, bizarre climate agenda, which is really nothing more than an agenda of control. You know, you mentioned socialism earlier in your intro. Climate is really just socialism. It's a environmental camouflage for socialism. So should we pay higher gas prices for that? No. What should Joe Biden be doing? He should be, if Joe Biden was really for Americans and America, he would unleash the American oil industry. That is the only way out of this crisis and any crisis like it. We have all the oil in the world that we need. And by the way, Europe has the same thing. Europe doesn't need to be in this boat either. We could make Russia irrelevant. You know, before, right at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, we were so energy dominant that the price of oil for a while went below zero.
Wow.
Now, Joe Biden doesn't want to go back to those days because he's got his climate agenda.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And obviously, the answer is probably to just to reopen things here in the U.S. We can supply our own energy needs and we can help a lot of other nations. We used to be, at the beginning of last year, the U.S. was a net exporter of oil. Now we're not. So two things.
Right.
What happened there? What policies were put in place to change that? And why aren't we, at a time like this? I mean, I know this is diametrically opposed to their policies. Why not at least stop the bleeding here and allow us to at least tap into some of the resources we have?
Well, let's do this, the last question first, because the most important thing for the Biden administration is its climate agenda. It's not interested in cheap gasoline or easing pain at the pump. Its climate agenda is number one.
Yep.
It wants to make fossil fuels as expensive as possible. It wants to get people out of their gas-powered cars and into EVs.
Mm-hmm.
And why are we not energy, you know, dominant anymore? Well, this is all Joe Biden's fault. You recall that during the 2020 campaign, Joe Biden campaigned against fracking and against the oil industry and against emissions. And since his first actions in the White House, you know, to cancel the Keystone Pipeline, to put a hold on new oil and gas leasing on public lands, he has done nothing but make it more difficult and more expensive to produce oil in this country. And, you know, under President Trump, we were producing record amounts of oil and gas. Now we're not.
Yep. Just a question looking forward. I just took a flight. I was visiting my daughter. I was out of town. And she's going on a pilgrimage, and she says she had to put up extra money because fuel costs for her flight have gone up. And this is coming up in like a month or two when she's leaving. There are others. I work with a guy here who says, look, should I buy my airline ticket now? I want to take a trip in July, or should I wait? What's this going to do to the airline industry, which has been profoundly impacted by COVID? And now we're going to see soaring costs. As I was getting off the airplane last night, I spoke to a guy who does a lot of travel, and he says, look, airline tickets have practically doubled to the location he has to travel to frequently. So your thoughts on how this will affect a lot of other industries? We know that as truckers have got to pay more for fuel, the cost of groceries and supplies, everything's going to go up. So the economy is going to be impacted. How will this affect the airline industry? Should people buy their tickets now, just as they should fill up their car now? And what do you see for the future?
Well, I don't want to cause any panic or anything like that, but I don't see any way oil prices are not just going to keep going up in the near future, and possibly until, you know, Joe Biden is no longer president. He has no intention of doing anything to lower prices. The world is crazy right now. What's going to happen with airfares? Yeah, you're going to be paying fuel surcharges as we have before during, you know, other energy crises. I mean, this is a real problem. You know, the 81 million that voted for Joe Biden, they have put us in quite a pickle. And I'm not quite sure how we get out of it anytime soon. I mean, I'm hoping that at least Congress can change, you know, in November. Maybe we get Republicans in charge of Congress. That's a start. But Joe Biden, you know, he's got that perch in the White House. And if it's not Joe Biden, it's Kamala Harris.
Right.
You know, it's a real problem for us. And I'm not quite sure what the answer is there.
Okay. Jim is listening in Skokie, Illinois. Jim, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is, the Biden policies increasing the cost of fuel and gas, is this not affecting the people who can least afford it?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, this is terribly regressive. It hurts lower-income people and people on fixed incomes the worst. It's a very twisted policy. I have never seen a president in my lifetime, and I'm pretty old, who was not worried about gas prices. And Joe Biden is not. He and his regime are doing everything they can to get those higher because of that climate agenda.
Ruth is listening in Austin, Texas. Ruth, you're on the air. Good afternoon.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm just alarmed at the assumptions and of the intentions of Biden and the administration to raise prices and stuff. We're not looking at the big picture here of, like, corporations like auto industry buying up patents and to, like, the trolley companies and such. They don't want mass transit, and that's what we need. And we do need to get off oil. We need to protect our ecology. And I don't think it's socialism, like, to have universal health care and have public schools and such. So I just don't buy all this. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth. Appreciate it. Okay, Steve, well, I'll let you respond.
Yeah, so look, you know, if you want to have all these social welfare programs and a clean environment, that's all great, but that takes money, and money comes from a productive economy. And if you're just going to pointlessly make energy more expensive, you're going to make us poor. Poor countries have the worst environment. Go to Russia, go to India, go to China, go to any poor country. Their environments are terrible. They can't afford their social welfare systems. Only wealthy countries can do that. So don't make us poor. Let's produce all the energy we can.
Yeah, I was working with somebody here who said to me, hey, look, what about the free market that is taking place here? You know, these green policies that are now in place, you know, they kind of choke out the current industry. Like, can oil producers open things up despite what the administration says? Probably not. So what happens to the free market here, and how is this affecting, you know, the current industry?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not really a free market at this point, because it's sort of an arbitrary market. You know, the government now, there was a big hearing on this in Congress last week. The government wants to use climate as a factor in deciding whether or not to grant permits for pipelines. And, you know, Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia, was very much against this. Yeah. And all it's going to do is make it riskier and more expensive and less likely that pipelines are going to be produced, that our oil is going to be produced. I mean, this is not improving the environment. It's not improving public health. It is just shutting down. It's an attack on the oil industry and attack on the American consumer.
Yeah. Great conversation with you, Steve. I'm grateful for your time. Let's do it again. We'll continue to see how these gas prices go. I'd love to talk environment and a lot of other things with you as well. But thanks for making time for us today.
Okay, Drew. Thank you.
That's Steve Aloy. He is the founder of JunkScience.com. That's JunkScience.com. You can check out that website. Stay with me. I need to take a short break. When we come back, I know it's easy to get fearful over all this, right? You wonder, how is this going to impact me? I can barely make the bills now. I want to address that when we come back. I think fear and anxiety are not from God. In fact, I'll speak to somebody about that a little bit later in the broadcast as well, but stay with me. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Chaplet of Divine Mercy begins soon on Relevant Radio.
That's right. I think that's the solution, don't you, to the problems we face? Prayer. I mean, we are in Lent. Should be a time of deeper prayer, more penance, fasting, sacrifice, almsgiving. We should be doing all those things. You and I have been chosen, I really believe, to live at this particular moment in time. These can be very frightening times. You know, there's no question about that. But more than ever, it's a time for us to put our trust in the hands of the Lord. I was actually praying the other day, and I was thinking about this. And, you know, I refuse to allow anxiety to rise or fear to dominate. I just will not do it. I refuse. And I reflect quite often on the writings of St. Faustina and the importance of trust. All the great saints understood how important trust was, you know. And we just, you know, there might be fear about war. We'll talk about that coming up a little bit later. I think Satan loves to instill anxiety and fear in the heart of us. But there's also concerns just about the future. I mean, you know, if you're going to fill up your gas tank, I mean, how much is that going to cost, right? If you've got to pay more for groceries, what are you going to choose? There are some people who get in line and they have to put items back because they cannot afford certain items. I mean, that's a tough decision for some parents to make, right? And what about some other people who are in a very vulnerable financial situation? Maybe right now you're facing a lot of debt. Maybe you got student loans, or maybe you have got medical bills, or maybe you're a little bit behind on the credit cards, or whatever the situation may be. You know, you have to remember God is a God of providence. He's a God of providence. And I believe this, he will never, ever abandon you. And I want you to know that. I think you need to hear that. So when you see these reports, when you start to get fearful, that's not from God. Now, does God provide? I'm going to ask, does God provide? What would you say? You'd say yes, right? Amen. It's a stupid question, right? Of course he provides, Drew. Why would I think otherwise? But very often in our lives, we act like he doesn't. And look, I'm no saint. I do too. Sometimes I have got to struggle in this. I got to fight this temptation to give into that fear or that doubt. How often is it that you're anxious when a check is going to come through? You're looking at your bank account and you think, oh gosh, I hope that covers. How often do you give to the church and say, oh, you know, charity begins at home. I really can't afford to give to this organization right now. The gas is too high, or you know, I know all the excuses we make, but there's something you need to learn about God's providence. He always gives in the way that he wants. And there's surprising ways. It's not dollar for dollar. I was sharing this with my wife the other day. I think it was my daughter. I was talking to her about the situation that, you know, when you give, sometimes you don't recognize how God gives back. You know, it might be a surprise raise or a bonus. It could be, you know, a rebate that you get for something. It might be a super great discount on something you're getting. It may be a gift from somebody else. I mean, God comes in all sorts of ways. I remember hearing a story about a woman named Kimberly Eddy, and she writes about how her husband's job cut his pay, right? And she was a stay-at-home mom. They didn't have a vehicle that could handle their whole family or even a dining room table to fit, you know, their family around. They had a pretty big family, and they were living on a third of what they had before, you know, before this situation took place, and they were near the poverty line. And she was on the verge of despair, and I get it. It's really hard to have faith when you struggle financially. So the daughter was at school, Sunday school one day, and one of her daughter's teachers suggested making something called a blessing box. So she was going to write down on separate pieces of paper all the things that God had blessed her with and then put them in a shoebox. And when she was having a bad day, just open the box and pull it out and read some of the things God blessed her with. So Kimberly took the idea, and instead of using a shoebox, what she did was she used a notebook. And now every year she gets a notebook, and she writes what she calls her blessing journal. And she's got listed some of the things that have happened to her since she started keeping track. And I'll share a couple of those. She says, he blessed their garden. How? They canned 500 jars of vegetables. they did a lot of dehydration and they felt like God bless that produce, right? Their meat chickens that they raise, instead of being 5 pounds or less, they were 10 pounds. So God surprises us, right? He can provide in ways that we would never even think of. She said God provided clothing for her children all year long through people who just felt led to give them things that they never even expressed a need for. You know, one of their daughters asked for rollerblades for her birthday. They couldn't afford them, right? They could barely get by. So they prayed about it, yeah, and they prayed with their daughter about it. They told her that if God provided for rollerblades, that'd be the only way she'd get them because they can't afford them. Well, later that week, a lady from the church put a bag of clothes in their car, and in the bag was a new pair of rollerblades. And guess what? They were her size. That is God's providence. That's how God works. He's in total control of everything. Total control of everything, you know? Down to your shoe size. There was a columnist for the Arlington Herald in Virginia. I think her name was Elizabeth Foss. I remember sharing this story once before. She wrote a few years back about her husband made a career move that was a financial leap in faith. And when he made that move, they found out she was pregnant, right? And she was concerned, right, about maternity clothes and newborn clothes and all the baby clothes from their other sons and younger kids that were worn out. They were yellowed. And her sister, as it turned out, had just had a baby at the same time Elizabeth was pregnant. And she wrote, my sister, she said, has incredibly good fashion sense and means to carry out her vision. And she told me not to buy a thing, right? She ended up giving me the entire maternity wardrobe that she had never even seen a washing machine, she said, because she had dry cleaned her clothes. And she goes, she's a little taller than me, but she insisted that she'd have everything altered to fit. And she'd even buy new things if we ever needed them again. She goes, that's how God provides. God has impeccable taste. He can give you those first class items. So, you know, if you're going through a difficult time or you're worried about the rising cost of gas or the rising cost of food or any of these other issues, know that God does provide. He does. You just have to trust that He will. And sometimes that trust is hard to come from by. It really is. But you need to do it. You need to do it because God is your Father. You know, He is your Father, and He will provide what you need. So let's pray about it right now, all right? We're going to pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. If you have a particular need, if you have a want, if you are struggling financially, let's turn to the Lord. Let's ask for His blessing on your health. Let's ask for His blessing on your relationships. Let's ask for His blessings on your finances. It's okay to pray that God blesses your finances. I know sometimes we think that that's not something we should do. You certainly can. You certainly can. I mean, God understands the need to provide. He multiplied loaves and fishes, right? We saw that. He demonstrated how He can turn water to wine. He can come through in the most impossible situations in the most miraculous ways, and I know He can do the same thing for you. Well, take your calls. If you're new to the program, every day at this time, I stop and I pray what's called the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. It was a prayer given to St. Faustina. She was the first saint of the new millennium, and Jesus appeared to her and revealed to her the beauty of God's mercy, and He called her the secretary of His mercy. And one of the great gifts that He gave is this prayer called the Chaplet, and it's attached with many promises from the Lord Himself, and we've seen miracles happen because of it. You can join me at 888-914-9149. If you're struggling with your faith, if you're struggling with fear, anxiety, despair, why not pray to God right now to ask you to have the grace to rise above that, to lift that veil of darkness. Let's also ask God to give you the miracle that I know you so deeply need, all right? We'll pray together for one another when I return.